Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to Hawk Binge, your protection from the soul-stealing black sword of chaos that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of a long-term fan, which is me, and your favourite first-time listener, who is Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andy. Hope I sound way better than I did last time.
Yeah, and I also have a new microphone, so I should now be coming across somewhere between Richard Burton and a James Earl Jones.
I think it's going to make us sound more authoritative as we go on.
That's hard to imagine anything could achieve that.
Either way, I'm glad to be back, because the last third of that last episode did make my editing heart sad. As soon as it happened, I was like, oh no. But, you know, unfortunately, could not be helped. And thank you to everyone who put up with it.
There was so much debate about the content of the episode that the quality of the recording seems to have passed everybody by. Now, this is a special bonus episode where we will get into the Chronicle of the Black Sword tour and the Live Chronicles live album of it, which was one of the three live albums that we'd set our stall out, or I'd set our stall out, because Matt didn't know they existed, to do bonus episodes of, obviously, Space Ritual, Live 79, and this one. And there is a lot to say. It means that we're not doing our usual turntable picks and the music of the day and all this kind of stuff, because, of course, it's pretty similar to what it was last time out. We will be addressing a lot of the comments and the debates that we got when we get to Xenon Codex. There are two messages that we got that definitely bear referencing, and the first of those is from none other than John Coulthart himself, right, Matt?
Yes, Mr. Coulthart himself. This is kind of a pincer attack, because I wasn't sure if he would realise that we had talked about his work, because I'm not sure if he followed the podcast. So I actually emailed him out of nowhere and just said, hey, we do this, and would you fancy doing a follow-up? We got a really nice reply from him saying, basically, I don't do spoken interviews. I'm a writer, which is perfectly fine. So thank you very much to him for politely backing out. But he did give us a few things to think about, and I'm going to quote him here. Incidentally, the overly blue cast on the front of the Chronicle album was a printer's error. I never used to see proofs of the artwork before printing, so I didn't know about this until the album turned up in the shops. You can see how the colours should look by comparing the front and back covers. The back cover looks fine colour-wise, and the back cover of the tour programme, which reproduced the colours as they were on the original artwork. But our idea that it was a very wonderful piece of art that just could not gel with the need to print en masse was a true one. But he did give us a couple of extra other minor points, and I quote again, the artwork on the cover of the Griffin CD was apparently used because the head of Griffin liked Robert Gould's covers for the Elric books, hence the similar art on Live Chronicles. And regarding my sword design, this was based on some of the very first Elric illustrations by James Cawthorne, a long-term friend and collaborator of Moorcock's. Jim also painted the Medallius t-shirt that Dave Brock used to wear on stage during the 70s and 80s, the art depicting one of the characters from the Hawk Moon books. So thanks so much, John, for following up and giving us a few little extra tidbits of information. I thought that was very illuminating.
Yeah, very much appreciate that from John. Let's face it, people are under absolutely no obligation whatsoever to respond to completely cold emails and calls and things. So yeah, that's really cool, and good to know that we weren't too far off the mark when we talked about that stuff.
Before we jump onto the other large message, I do want to do one clarification before this spirals out of control and becomes the new properties of Quark mail that we constantly get. And that is the fact that in one of my references when I talked about Shadegate, I talked about a album called Kosmischer Läufer, which was a synth-based album. And I described it as being part of the East German athletic coaching music from the late 70s. I think because I went on such a long rant about that, in the edit, I tried to cut it out because it was already a 2.5 hour long podcast at that point, and I wanted to try and cut it for length where possible, to the point where I think I cut out the fact that it's not real. It's actually a contemporary take on what the East German athletic team for the Olympics might have been. Thank you for everyone who did correct me, and I do still recommend people check them out, but if they do, check them out in the fictitious spirit that they are presenting. And there wasn't really, unfortunately, an East German Olympic team music synthologist coach, although there really should have been.
On to our second message from the one and only Mr. Darren Everson, who has spoken to us a number of times before. He had something interesting to say, Matt.
Yes, he did, Andy, and I'm going to read this verbatim from YouTube where he posted it. Once again, you guys pull out of the bag and take on the Chronicles with all its odd faults and standout riffs. It was a great live show with Tony Carrera as Elric, some creative stage lighting and backdrops. An ambitious project with the big financial backing of a major record label shows the scope of a band who can still amaze and surprise with their scope for storytelling. For further reading on the album, I can recommend the great chronicler himself, Ian Abrahams, article in Record Collector number 446. It's always a pleasure to read anything by a journalist and author of his magnitude.
Wow. Well, given that this is a special bonus episode, we have a special bonus guest, and we are very happy to be in the presence of an author and journalist of such magnitude, Mr. Ian Abrahams himself. Ian, welcome to Hawkbinch.
Hello, chaps. I don't recognise myself in that description, but it's very nice anyway. And actually, I was just rereading that article for Record Collector from those few years back on the Chronicle of the Black Sword, and I think it was the most difficult bit of Hawkwind writing I'd done. I tried to get hold of Harvey for it and had no luck. And I had a nice chat with Dave about it, but the thing just didn't quite come together. And it's one of my lesser entries into the canon of writing about Hawkwind, I think.
Darren disagrees.
Well, it's very kind of Darren, for sure. Thank you very much, mate, if you're listening to this.
Excellent. Welcome aboard. And how are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. Yeah, no, looking forward to chatting to you guys. Been following the podcast. I haven't heard them all yet, to be honest with you, but I have heard most of them and love what you're doing. And that idea of what you learn by listening to things chronologically is a really interesting thing.
Thanks so much. And yeah, it's great to know that yourself are listening to the show. That means a lot to us as well. Ian, of course, is the author of Sonic Assassins. I am holding that book up now. If you're listening to this on the podcast, that will not be good podcasting. But if you're watching it, there it is. We've been reading from that basically for each show, getting some insights and background and takes on things from Ian. And it's been a brilliant resource for us. It takes us up to much more recent times than I thought. When I was reading through it, I didn't realize that you went right up to The Machine Stops.
Well, you've very kindly held up the currently in print paperback edition, the original hardback published by, I never knew whether they called themselves SAF or simply SAF Publishing, but that was back in 2003, 2004. And then the paperback edition that you were holding came out in 2017, I think, which I'd done not just an addition to, but really a top to bottom rewrite. The original edition of the Hawkwind book was the first thing of any substance I'd ever written. And so with the benefit of 13 years experience, the paperback was a chance to rewrite the whole thing, drop a load of material in that I didn't have for the first edition, but I gathered over the years, and then do the update to make it current at the time. And you're right, it stops with The Machine Stops.
So Ian, when you wrote the book, were you a Hawkwind fan who decided to write about Hawkwind, or did your kind of love of the band come as a result of writing the book?
Oh, it's a bit of both, Andy. I'd written for comics fanzines and things, so I was a budding amateur writer for a little while. And then around about 1983, I'd had a go at submitting a couple of reviews to Sounds newspaper, which they kindly rejected. And undeterred, many, many, many years later, I thought I'd have another go. I wanted to be a journalist, but I wasn't. And I wanted to write a book. And what could I write about? Well, there'd never been a book on Hawkwind. And I'd loved Hawkwind ever since I'd been listening to Live 79, which my cousin would play in his car when he drove us to gigs at the Cornwall Coliseum, as it was in the 80s. It was a huge venue on the beach near St Austell, about 3,000 standing, I believe. But he'd always have this Live 79 on. I said, oh, what's this? And I'd sort of vaguely heard of Hawkwind. I knew Silver Machine, and I'd seen the clip of them doing Silver Machine that got used as a Top of the Pops promo clip. I'd seen that on a documentary about Michael Moorcock that the BBC did in about 1980, Time Out of Mind. So I sort of vaguely in the back of my mind thought, oh, Hawkwind are interesting, but I didn't really know much about them. And there we are going to The Jam and to The Who and Elvis Costello at the Coliseum with Shot Down in the Night and Spirit of the Age ringing in my ears. So consequently, I bought Live 79, loved it. So the next thing I did was buy Quartz, Strangeness and Charm, expecting to hear something similar to Spirit of the Age from Live 79. And of course, as we know, it's completely different. And you go, oh, this is interesting. They don't play everything the same way all the time. And just got into it from there. So when I finally licked my wounds from having a rejection from Sounds however many years later, I thought I'd like to write a book. So I wrote a specimen first chapter, sent it to Chris Tate, Chris Brock as she is now, said, I want to write a book about Hawkwind. What did you think of this? And she was very kind and wrote back and said, yeah, we liked it, but Dave remembers some of it differently. Perhaps you ought to come and have a chat. And so we did this interview for a couple of hours. And then Dave said, well, we've got Alan and Richard rehearsing at our place at the moment. So why don't you come back and meet them? So I went away buzzing, thinking, oh, I wonder who publishes music books. So what if I go to the local Waterstones and there's SAF Publishing with a book on Kraftwerk? And I thought, oh, that's got to be interesting then. I'll send it to them, see what they think. And 2 or 3 weeks later, got a phone call to say, yeah, we'll do it. Where do we send the advance? So it was just rollercoaster stuff, you know. But in a long way of answering your question, it was a bit of both. I wanted to be a writer. I knew I was never a fiction writer, but thought I could have a go at doing some journalism, and coincided it with what do I love the most? Well, I love Doctor Who and Hawkwind. Doctor Who's been covered to death. I'll do a book on Hawkwind because there ain't one, you know. That's the story.
Well, we're glad you did. It's a wonderful book and definitely well worth a read for anyone out there. And you've kind of stayed with it, haven't you? Because you reviewed Somni last year. So you're still in the journalism and the writing and even Hawkwind.
To a degree, the day job is pretty all-consuming in the headspace at the moment. And I've done very little stuff over the last 18 months or so. Quite a lot of Hawkwind work before that in different publications and sleeve notes and stuff. But I was privileged last year to do the notes for Dave Brock's curation of Space Rock and Other Psych Music box set that Cherry Red put out. So that was really lovely. A really nice note from Dave one Friday night afterward, just saying thanks for all your work on it. You know, you've clearly worked really hard and thanks for that, which was just lovely to receive. And, you know, really nice to be involved in that one. But yeah, last 18 months, a little bit famine in terms of the amount of writing I've done, but hopefully I can get back to it again.
Yeah, that would be great. And lovely to hear from Dave. And that is a really solid release. That is a triple album box set, isn't it? It's really nice.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, really joins up the different strands of influence on Hawkwind, you know, from the free festival scene to the American DIY bands and stuff. So, you know, I think it's a good capture of particularly 1980s Hawkwind legacy. It's all about the legacy, you know.
Yeah, it is all about the legacy. Speaking of which, we are obviously here to talk about Black Sword and the shows and the live element. But it's interesting that we put out the Black Sword episode just over a week ago. And it's interesting that one of your first Hawkwind albums was Quark, Strangeness and Charm, because Black Sword and Quark, Strangeness and Charm have seen the biggest leaps in listenership for us. There's been a steady build of audience as we've released episodes and people have got other people on board. And then there's a big jump when we release Quark. And then there's a big jump when we release Black Sword. A difference with Black Sword is just the amount of debate about that album.
Yeah.
I must admit that going in to record that episode, I thought that Matt was going to dislike that album. That was how I felt on the inside. In fact, Matt had fewer issues with it than I thought he would have. But there are posts from people who are lovely about the show, but say they don't like the album. And then there'll be a whole load of, but I love it. And then someone else, no, it's awful. And these debate just carries on. It's probably the most polarizing album certainly we've hit so far.
It's really curious, and I have been following some of those posts on Facebook over the last week, and there's a lot of negativity about it that really surprises me. I think back in the day when it came out, and we'd been sort of a bit starved of Hawk stuff since the RCA era, we'd had the Earth Ritual EP, but in 1983 they played, I think, about 9 gigs, you know, they'd really taken a backseat. And then you had the 1984 tours with Nick that at the time went down very badly in my recollection, and there was a lot of people who didn't like the punk element that Nick brought back into the band from his inner city unit thing. So there's a lot of negativity, and suddenly you get this great burst of stuff with their appearance on ECT on Channel 4 doing The Right Stuff and Angels of Death. And then you had the album of the Black Sword, and we were all cheering then. What I think happens in fandoms, and this is not unique to Hawkwind, is that a prevailing view sort of comes along, and it's not a herd mentality, but people sort of adopt the prevailing view. And the prevailing view at the moment is very focused on the 1970s. I get that. That's the classic era. But Hawkwind isn't just Born to Go and Blanger, Blanger, Blanger. You know, it's much bigger than that. You know, it's the festival scene of the 80s. It's the trio thing in the 90s. So there's a lot more to Hawkwind than just the 70s. So for a while, an album will be seen as, you know, this is top drawer stuff. And then the view will shift almost en masse, and it suddenly become negative. And then it gets a reappraisal again. And that's not unique to Hawkwind. You know, I often compare Hawkwind and Doctor Who in terms of the way that both things regenerate themselves in lineup and tone. And, you know, there's Doctor Who stories that 1 minute are hated and then become top five and then ebbs down the list again. And that's the sort of way the tide of fandoms moves en masse. And it seems to have moved en masse against Black Sword at the moment, and for its limitations, as I say, back in the day we were cheering David Tibbett and Sounds comparing it to what Jazz Coleman and Killing Joke were doing in the nighttime Love Like Blood era, and very favourably, you know. So this the tide in the view of fandoms, and I'm sure that it'll come back again, that this was rather a nice album, and that sort of 75 Warrior, 85 Black Sword, 95 Alien thing, which was held up as, you know, that there's a peak once every decade, that view will probably come back again, but it just isn't there at the moment. But, you know, I get that in the way fandoms work.
Absolutely. Matt, of course, we're talking here about appraising and reappraising and reappraising and things going up and down. And fandom, as Ian points out, this was for you what it was for us in 85 when it came out. I'm guessing that you weren't particularly prepared for the debate that that show would cause.
No, and I tried to give myself a bit of a bubble because I am trying to look at this without the kind of groupthink. And I think even on that last podcast, I was surprised where this album came in the fan rankings. I thought it was going to be higher. I do feel that a lot of people seem to come in around here. You know, a lot of people were saying this was my first gig, or this was the first time I'd heard of them. And then so you have a time when it means something more because you've seen it. And, you know, it's almost impossible then to detangle the album from your life experience.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we have a strict no spoilers, no influences thing for you to keep that pure to a certain degree. And I think when you do really like something, there's a certain joy that comes from our listeners, the fact that you really like something, that wouldn't be there if you didn't also dislike things. And I think the acid test was your infamous dislike of Assault and Battery, which we will revisit slightly later. When we were recording that, in my head, I was thinking, oh, this is going to blow up. And then, of course, it didn't really. People were quite accepting of that. So it's a brilliant fandom for that. And of course, this generation of people who came in here, as you so rightly say, includes both me and Ian. Isn't that right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I came in a little bit before that. I think the first album that I bought that was the contemporary album was Sonic Attack. I remember buying it in Woolworths, and we were the first town to lose their Woolworths, and we lost ours 20 years before Woolworths went bust. So we were ahead of the curve. But that was the first one I'd actually bought, and I'd seen the band at Cornwall Coliseum in 1982 on a, as I recall, it was a joint CND and Trelisk Hospital had an appeal for a CAT scan equipment. But the second thing I ever saw was Black Sword, yeah.
That's amazing. They did that tour for a couple of years, right? Did you see it quite early on in the run?
The Black Sword tour itself was autumn into December 1985. I saw it at Bristol Hippodrome, which I, as I recall, was the very last night of the tour, and a bit of a party atmosphere, as I remember it. You're right, they did remount it in 87 at the World Science Fiction Convention. There was talk of a tour of it in Poland, I remember. I don't know whatever happened to that. That never happened.
What did you make of it back then? Because it's not just the band coming on and playing a selection of its music. It's the whole theatrical element of it. As we heard in Darren's message earlier, you had Tony Crera, who, at least in my memory, was a big guy decked out as Elric with the big sword running around and the narration and everything else. How did that impact you?
Well, the gig experience is what surrounds it as well as what happens at the gig, you know, and that's what you take with you. And what was I in 85? I was in 22, so I wasn't a youngster. But Black Sword was the first time I'd actually driven away to the big city for a gig. And so we'd set out at some ungodly hour, because it took like 5 hours to drive to Bristol from Redruth in those days, before there was a lot more bypasses before you get to the M5. So it was a big road trip for us, which was, you know, really a big spirit of adventure to go and see Hawkwind. And I tell you, we had this idea that Dave was in his 40s and we ought to go and see Hawkwind now because we might not get a chance again, you know. So we had this exciting thing of, you know, loading up the car and going to Bristol. And of course, it's in the days before internet and Expedia. We booked no hotel and we didn't know where the hotels were. And we're really anxious to get into Bristol because we'd heard about a really great comic shop called Forever People in Park Street in Bristol and a couple of good record shops on the same street. And, you know, we were anxious to go and get to those shops before we went to the gig. We got lost in the city centre and they had this massive steel flyover in the city centre that went from nowhere to nowhere. And apparently had been designed by some kids in a school competition to design the road layout around Bristol. And then the planners looked at it and thought, this is a really good idea, we'll have this. And it was there for years until they figured it went nowhere and demolished it. But we're on the top driving around thinking, where are the hotels, you know? And we come across the Grand Hotel near the Bristol Hippodrome. So it's got to be good. And it was where Tony Benn used to stay when he was MP for Bristol. And it was quite upmarket, you know. And we rock up there with our Hawkwind t-shirts and our ripped jeans and our stud belts and stuff and wander into the foyer of this hotel looking for a room and spent probably three times as much as we needed to so that we could get ourselves to the comic shops and the record shops and then go and see Hawkwind at Bristol Hippodrome, which is a lovely old theatre. You know, every time after that, we saw them in Bristol in the 80s and early 90s. We'd always saw them at Colston Hall or Bristol Beacon, as it is now. But it was the whole spirit of adventure that surrounds that that makes it part of our nostalgia for the time when we were really getting into Hawkwind and becoming what a lot of people are with Hawkwind, travelling fans, you know.
So true. And does kind of come back to that thing about this album and this tour and this whole period of Hawkwind being quite a seminal period in the band for a generation of people coming on board and remembering these things. And that whole concept of the album does give it that kind of theatrical impact.
Well, it does. And the thing for me was, certainly seeing it on the last night, it was really party night. But in terms of the album itself, and what makes the album difficult, I guess, is the fact that it has all the effects and fight sequences still built into it. So, you know, as a piece of musical theatre, in a way, it was quite a strong narrative, which doesn't quite come across on the album itself. But it just had an atmosphere of trying to do something on a budget. When you compare it with Space Ritual, Space Ritual has this mystique, doesn't it? I mean, the album's wonderful, and it doesn't have the complications of Live Chronicles in terms of trying to present a capture of a stage show with a dramatic storyline in quite the same way. So you have the music and you have Bob's spoken pieces, whereas on Live Chronicles, you have all of the effects and stuff like that. That's hard to visualize what's going on now. But you've got the abbreviated jettisoned video of the Hammersmith gigs, and you've got plenty of photography. So you can look back on it now and say, oh, was it a bit Spinal Tap or was it? But Space Ritual has this mystique because there's a few murky pictures and a wonderful album and no film. And you're right, a lot of fandom joined around the time that you and I are talking about joining, you know, that mid-80s thing. They're not people who came from 1972 and have vivid memories of Space Ritual. You know, again, my Doctor Who comparison. What are the classic Doctor Who 1960 stories? Oh, guess what? They're the ones that are missing.
Yeah. So true. And I'm one of those who joined around this time. So I had some Hawkwind albums. I'm very murky in my memory of how much Hawkwind I had at Chronicle of the Black Sword, because I didn't get Chronicle of the Black Sword when it came out because I didn't know about it. Back then, Kerrang! Was basically how I learned about anything, and it wasn't like I subscribed. So a lot of things went on, and then you'd hear about it later. So I got Black Sword at some point in 86, and I think I started to backfill Hawkwind from there. I had one or two albums, but not much. And I got Black Sword, and either I read all the Moorcock stuff because I had Black Sword, or I got Black Sword because I read all the Moorcock stuff. I can no longer remember. But the tour was done. I'd seen a couple of gigs by then. I'd seen Queen in 84, and I saw them again in 86. I saw Genesis in 86. I hadn't seen Hawkwind yet, but I had a very, very interesting week in 1987 when all that changed. Because the first time I saw Hawkwind was when they played Acid Days in Finsbury Park, which was on the 23rd of August, 1987. And of course, they finished the set with Silver Machine, with Lemmy coming in. I looked it up. The set list that day, basically, you have an intro, Angels of Death, Assault and Battery, Lost Chronicles, Needle Gun, Rocky Paths, Waiting for Tomorrow, Master of the Universe, Shade Gate, Dragons and Fables, Arrival in Utopia, Moonglum, Brainstorm, Dreamworker, Hassani Saba, Urban Gorilla, and Silver Machine. So as a first Hawkwind gig, it's a pretty solid one. 5 days later was the World Science Fiction Convention in Brighton, where I am. And I went to the World Science Fiction in Brighton in 1987. And of course, Hawkwind played on the Friday night. So basically, I saw them twice in 5 days, having not seen them before. And of course, they did the Black Sword in the Brighton Centre. They were kind of guests of honour at the Science Fiction Convention. I met Michael Moorcock. He was doing book signings. So he was fun. And I think I got a 1 day ticket, but I managed to turn it into 2 days by sleeping in the cinema when they did a 24-hour science fiction films. The only thing I can remember from that was that they showed a pilot episode of Captain Scarlet. And he gets horribly shot to pieces in an alleyway before the Mysterons resurrect him and he becomes immortal. And I remember sitting there thinking, there's no way they would show this to children today. And this was 87 when I was thinking that. It's a pretty horrendous scene. He's riddled with bullets.
And he finally gets thrown off a building at the very end, right?
Yes.
So it's not a good day for him.
No, he had a bad day. It's got to be said. There's a definite concept album to be made about Captain Scarlet. So I did that and then saw the show, and the whole thing does exist on YouTube, but I think it's a fan recording and probably therefore horrible.
Yeah, there is a bootleg that circulates. Now, Dave and Chris tell me that they think somebody filmed it as well, and there was a short clip of it on a local news program, but nobody's been able to track down who. And I've asked around a little bit, but never picked up any leads on it.
That would be amazing. I was leaning on the front of the stage. I was that close to it, which is why I remember Tony Crerar as being such a huge guy running around with the swords, thinking I might get one in the eye any second. Matt, I did ping you a few YouTube clips, but the quality of those YouTube clips are awful. But they're from the Hammersmith gig. They're not great pictures. I don't know if you managed to see any of it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw what I could. It's one of those difficult things, isn't it? When something which wasn't wonderfully filmed in the first place is then uploaded to another medium with all the compression and corruption that that gives us. But at least from it, I can glean that it was something to be witnessed, you know? And I think that's something that probably will become part of my lamentation when we talk about the actual album itself, is that even when we've seen them before, especially when they did the Space Ritual anniversary, they are an audio visual band. Less so maybe in the studio, but like Live 79 and kind of Space Ritual, every time I listen to these, I feel like I'm missing something. There's a dimension to it which you can never quite grasp. So it was nice to be able to grab these little bits that exist to at least try and paint some kind of picture. But certainly, I'm sure I am still missing, you know, 99.9% of the vibe, unfortunately.
I think the Jettison video that came out was quite nice, actually, you know, and compared to the one they did for the 1984 tour. I think it's called Night of the Hawks, doesn't it? You know, it's a step forward from that. It's definitely done on a budget again. That's the beautiful thing about Hawkwind. It's always on a budget. You know, that's what makes it special. There's some nice clips, and certainly that one of Moonglum, which starts with a little bit of the light show and then fades into Hugh on his own carving out the initial chords to Moonglum. I think that clip of Hugh is just iconic in Hawkwind history. I think it's just beautiful.
Good segue there. Let's get into the album and the music. And before we start getting into some of the tracks themselves, one thing, Matt, that you mentioned when we were chatting about this, with the studio album, you made quite a point of the fact that not knowing the story was no barrier to getting into the music and enjoying the album. But you found that not quite to be the case with the live.
No, with the live one, I felt a lot more out in the cold, almost from the get-go. I mean, it's nice to be welcomed to an album. When they say welcome to the Chronicle of the Black Sword, I'm like, cool, thanks. But then immediately they go into, we're going to tell you a story about this dude, and then start just talking about it all. And all of the stuff I was listening to just made me feel like, ah, this is going to be much more in the world of Elric than I'm going to be prepared for. If I'd have been there and seen the theatrics and the performances and that kind of thing, then maybe it would have been easier to have maybe enjoyed it, in the same way that I'd not heard Space Ritual before I went and saw it with you. And, you know, having the dancers around and everyone wearing strange headdresses and lights and that classic kind of 70s gel projections, you know, it helps, right? It softens the blow of something you don't know much about.
That was Warrior on the Edge of Time.
Sorry, yes, you're right. Warrior on the Edge of Time is what we saw for the anniversary. I'm sorry. I think I just have the word ritual in my head and I feel like that's what it was like watching.
It's all good. Just to prevent us getting our torrents of emails. It's interesting, actually. War of the Worlds is an album I love. I was in a record store once and I saw that there is an album which is highlights of War of the Worlds. And it almost feels to me now, Ian, I don't know if you'd agree, Live Chronicles is the Chronicle of the Black Sword. And Chronicle of the Black Sword is almost like a cut down version, because there's so much on Live Chronicles, particularly some of the big Hugh songs that aren't on Chronicle of the Black Sword. The Black Sword almost feels like the EP to the album.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me today listening to Live Chronicles is how Hugh-centric it is. Which I think is a good thing. I love his songs, even though the lyrics can be a little bit labored at times. I love his songs. I love his persona. I love his playing, even though, again, you know, it became a thing where it dominated the sound, where it needed to be part of the sound.
You're absolutely right. And that does take us beautifully into the music itself. And the first clutch of songs here, we do get a bit of narration to set things up. Welcome aboard. Song of the Swords, Dragons and Fables. And Matt, obviously, you were not particularly a fan of the sound of Dragons and Fables, which was on the Earth Ritual EP. I think your quote was that it felt like maybe the first time that Hawkwind had fought with 80s production and lost. Does it sound better here? Because there's definitely a sound that runs through Live Chronicles, very consistent kind of sound and instrumentation. Does Dragons and Fables stand up any better for you, given that?
Yeah, this is one of the tracks which lets me know that the drummer is human. There's some nice cymbal work at the end, especially, which makes you feel like there's someone behind the kit rather than a computer. The riff, when it came on straight after Song of the Swords, it's a nice riff to come into. I was like, oh yeah, I'm familiar with this now. The lyrics are harder to identify. I think that's just because of maybe just the liveness, but also I find that a lot of this is way faster than I think it needs to be. And that's just going to be like a meta commentary for me, is that the speed that a lot of this is played at, for me, it feels rushed. It feels like they're trying to get more energy by playing faster, and they're obviously going for some kind of sound. To jump all the way to the end really quickly, because I think this helps solidify my point, when they get to the final flight and they have another lyrical interlude, one of the lines is heavy metal songsters cut themselves another line, which for me makes it feel like they threw Lemmy out with the bathwater. That felt like a very defining lyric that sets up Hawkwind's position on themselves, at least for this tour. You know, something very different to the spacey groove jetters of the 70s, and I think a lot of that isn't here. And there wasn't a lot of it necessarily in Live 79 even, so maybe this is even more than before, but I never thought that they would describe themselves as heavy metal songsters. And I'm sure this is a self-referential line, you know, I'm sure that this is like a nod and a wink to everyone who's there, but I feel like it's explained why they're playing how they're playing. But for me, a lot of the tracks that they play don't benefit from being sped up, because as we said before, a lot of their tracks, that it's very thinky. It's, you want to listen to it. And I think the faster you play, you lose detail, you know, which is why normally punk bands are two or three chords at most, and you get the energy out in different ways. I feel like a lot of this feels quite rushed. And I think an example of that with Song of the Swords is that it almost feels delivered in a breathless way as the singer is trying to catch up to the speed of the track. And I remember listening to this the first time round and thinking, like, this is a less nuanced version because of the speed they're playing. I hope they don't do this through the whole album. And by the end of the album, I was like, God damn it.
But can I come in on that one a moment, if you don't mind?
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, I think you're right, Matt. And I think that there was that period, and it started in 84, really, where things got punked up a bit. And that was that particular lineup, you know, and things change so much through the years that any one version will be very different than another version. The one that benefits from that is Dragons and Fables, which is a lovely little song that I like a lot. I don't like the studio version on the Earth Ritual EP. It feels ploddy. And the same when it was played on the Spring 84 tour, if you listen to any of the bootlegs that are available. When you get to the Autumn 84 tour, when Alan's joined and Harvey's moved to keyboards and Dragons and Fables is being played in that set, suddenly it's got a little bit more pace in the riff, and suddenly it comes into its own. But I think it's that evolution from being recorded in the spring of 84, I think, until arriving on the winter tour in 84 with Alan on bass. It sort of gains just a little bit of pace in the riff and suddenly becomes a better song for it. But I take your point on the overall thing of the speed of some of the tracks.
I will go with you on that. I find this version wins me over at the end, and I can get lost in the more long form solo. And you're right, it is a riff which appreciates a little bit more action. I think for me, the lyrical delivery then makes it, I don't know, again, maybe it's me, but it feels like the singer's trying to keep up with the track rather than leading it. But no, from a musical point of view, I do like that. And like I said, with the humanity of the drums and everything, I like this as a live track.
I love Who's tracks, and I like his singing, but his enunciation of words is not always terribly clear in some of his songs. That's not just Dragons and Fables. That's across quite a few of his songs. You have to really stop and listen and say, oh, what were those words? But what a wonderful player. So I have to give him that for sure.
If you're a fan of Hugh Lloyd Langton guitar solos, there are some beautiful ones on this album for sure. It's funny you should say, Matt, I kind of feel a little bit like this. I remember our conclusion with Levitation was that we both love that album. It's one of your favorite of the albums that we've done. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we were glad that they didn't keep going with that, because it was a very one-off thing. This one, the feel of this, there is definitely more power and energy to this. And I like it. But I like it as the one-off package that it is, basically. And I wouldn't have wanted lots of other stuff to be with it. It's interesting you mentioned the drums, because Ian Danny had said that he was not a fan of the studio album because of the way that the drums were treated, but that he does like the live album. The drums are definitely, as they should be if you're a live drummer playing on stage, they are more natural here, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess the drums are sort of symptomatic of that mid-80s studio production feel on the studio album. And in the live environment, they're the live environment. environment. You get the same thing with Richard on Electric Teepee in a way. So I think, yes, you know, the dynamics of the live album are very different than the studio album, even though I wouldn't, you know, as a non-musician, talk about the technicalities of the music. But certainly it lets Danny do what Danny does a lot better than the very programmed sound of the studio album, for sure.
Very much so. So we've got another clutch of songs after that. We have some narration. Irkun has usurped his throne. And then we get Seeking, some more narration, Angels of Death. Matt, a couple of questions for you here. Seeking was one of those that you chose from the studio album to be on the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist. Do you still like it here as the live version? And in this version of Angels of Death, does it still remind you of Sultans of Swing?
I should just probably say, on the whole, I'm not a big live album person. So again, anyone who is listening to this and wanting to come and kick my door in, you've got to listen to this from the ignorance that it is spoken with. I remember as a kid, my dad had Genesis Live in the car a lot. And so that for me was kind of like a live album. And I've got one or two maybe like live things. I think I've said this before. I think I have like Billie Eilish live at Third Man Records and Fink Wheels Turn Beneath My Feet and one or two things. But generally, I'm a studio production kind of person. So, you know, I know there are nuances of live albums, which I don't necessarily appreciate compared to studios. But with all that said, the Seeking here for me does not feel as substantive as the studio version. It loses the cool depth charge sound, which they use in the narration, but then not in the track. And for me, that was one of the things that made the track. So I felt I was missing a key part of it that makes it something for me. And again, I feel like the band are rushing to keep up with the pace of the track, which creates this kind of like looser feel, which I actually feel like this track warrants some tightness. And I think it doesn't quite drop as hard. And again, it's live, so it may well have absolutely kicked ass if you were there. But the drop for me into the actual like chorus is not as hard. The last 40 seconds or so, I feel they finally catch the groove. And that 40 seconds for me, I really like. The Angels of Death, though, I like this one generally. Again, this is funny. The songs on the Black Sword that are sped up, I don't think work personally. Maybe it's because I'm now used to their speed. Maybe it's because I feel like that's the speed that they should be. But Angels of Death and a couple of other tracks, which I guess we'll get to, actually benefit from being kicked up a notch. So Angels of Death, it's nice to hear other album tracks joining the party because, you know, we've been very sword focused this whole time. Again, this is one of the things that made me feel like it's live in a Hawkwindy way, because I think the drummer fluffs the first fill, and I kind of like that. That's what makes it feel live, where Genesis Live, for example, has been obviously practiced to a mirror sheen to the point where it may as well not be live. But this feels like you're in it, and I liked that. The midway breakdown is still groovy and deserty, which is really nice. I think the vocals are slightly delivered without some of the character I like on the studio. But again, when it's live, I think you excuse that because you're very much like, you know, in the moment and you can't go back and go, oh, can I do that again? I feel like the chorus is slightly dispassionate. The original, I feel like I'm being sneered at by the king of a city thug gang, you know? And in this one, it feels more just like people are singing words. So I think that is the bit which loses me a little bit. But the breakdown is really nice. The building back into a more jammy noise bath for a moment is nice. It reminds me of like some of their previous stuff. So I think this one for me is a track which I enjoy. I'm not sure it surpasses the original, but I think it definitely fits nicely into the track list.
I blow hot and cold on Angels of Death, if I may say. I really like the version on Sonic Attack, and it fits in with Sonic Attack's concrete and metal Cold War vibe. The next best version is the version they played on ECT, coupled with The Right Stuff in 1985. And then it got back to what it was, I think, on the Space Bandits tour in 1990. So those are the versions I really like of Angels of Death. I think the interesting thing, if I can say it, and it probably relates to Assault and Battery particularly as well, is it's really interesting to hear this version of the band and the 84 version of the band trying out some of the 70s, early 80s standards in the style in which the band was playing at the time, sort of vaguely heavy metal type style of the band. And quite a few of them don't work in the format of the band as it is. So again, spoilers, when you get to the trio era, they bring some of these things in and they work really well. They don't work for this lineup. On live dates, they'd had a go at 7x7. Previous year, they'd had a go at Paradox. you got Assault and Battery here, and they don't really work in the same. I can't talk about Genesis Live, by the way, because I'm a punk rock kiddie, so I should love this stuff, but there are songs that really lend themselves to different versions of the band, and some of the stuff you hear either on Live Chronicles or on some of the tapes from the summer of 85, we're waiting for a different band to come along to play them in a way, I think. Interesting. One thing I was going to say also, just checking through some of the tapes, is how much of the Black Sword album was actually getting out there in the wild in the summer of 85. Song of the Swords in a proto version was out there. Shea Gate was out there. And actually, when I spoke to Dave for that record collector piece, he said, well, you've got to remember, Ian, some of these things were things that existed already that then fitted the vibe. So we always think of this album as being written for this album, but Needlegum probably wasn't. And Shea Gate might have been a Harvey thing that he'd worked out in the summer. And then when he got to recording the album, thought, oh yeah, that fits in, we'll have that one for the album. Sleep of a Thousand Tears is around as well in the summer, you know, only two or three gigs does it appear on, I think, but these things were in the wild beforehand. And that's completely at a tangent to what you guys are talking about, but I just, while it was in my head, I thought I'd throw that one in. But some of these tracks, what I mean is some of these were waiting for a different band to get them right, and 7x7 in the summer was a really good example of that, where a different version of Hawkwind would grab that in a different way and make it their own.
The idea of 7x7 being played at this speed fills me with horror. So I'm glad they left that one alone.
So we've got another batch of songs we move on to, and Shade Gate's one of them. And I'll just deal with that one separately for a second. Matt, does the ending of Shade Gate irritate you less this time round?
Yeah, because it finishes.
Took umbrage on that one, didn't you? You really took umbrage on that.
I was furious.
We could tell, you know, us listeners knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Again, this feels like it's played a little faster than the original. Some of these tracks could benefit maybe for some speed. Angels of Death, for sure. That's nice. Pump it up a bit. But some of the instrumentals like Shade Gate, when you speed it up a bit, I just feel like a Hawkwind just late for a bus or something. Are they just trying to like get through this?
There was a lot of songs to get through, you know, it was a big set list.
That's very true.
But the latter half, when it gives itself some more space, I like. The lack of the terrible ending means it's a much better version for me. I like the fact they can do it live. It's a bit faster, fine, but I lose the groove at the beginning, but eventually it gets into its own groove again, and I like it. So it's nice to have it on. And again, given the raucous pace that it's been on, I was not sure they'd even do this in this set, but I think it's a nice point to get your breath back. And if they were doing spacey theatrics and lights and stuff, this is still nice enough just to listen to. This doesn't feel like a handbrake in the way that some of their narration stuff has been. But yeah, I like Shade Gate.
From Shade Gate, we then get Rocky Paths, a bit more narration, Pulsing Cavern, which is the other synth-driven piece, and Master of the Universe. Any particular takes on this little batch of songs?
It's interesting, those ones that come in like Rocky Paths and Master of the Universe, you know, mention those two in one go. There was always a thing back in the day was, why couldn't we have had a Hawkwind gig of all new songs of the end? Why did they need to have these other ones slotted in? Of course, the ones that slot in do lyrically fit the narrative. But that's always a hardcore fan view, isn't it? You know, I'd love to go to a Hawkwind gig where it's all new stuff. Yes, so would I as a hardcore fan. And then 80% of the audience aren't a hardcore fan. They want to hear some of the standards, you know, and that's the difference between being a hardcore fan and saying that sort of thing and being a ticket buying punter who likes the band and knows Master of the Universe and Silver Machine. There's a practicality of mixing those things in. Pulsing Cavern, I really like much more than Shade Gate, actually. And I was trying to find evidence of this, but myself and my mate Stuart saw Hawkwind at Plymouth Academy in early 86. And of course, most of the Black Sword stuff had been dropped from the set. And that one had been kept in at the time. And I remember taking some photos that I no longer have, sadly, that Hugh, at the point they played Pulsing Cavern, went and sat on the raised podium for the drum kit and played along to it, you know, in a very laid back sort of way. And I gave the snaps to somebody thinking I had the negs, and I can never find the negatives again. So the evidence is lost. But I always liked that one. It always had a sort of immersive feel to it that worked really well. Rocky Paths, you know, another great Hugh Lloyd Langton song, you know. A little bit of an aside again, but the connection is Flickknife. I went up to interview Frenchie from Flickknife in Harrow a few years back now for Record Collector, and we'd had a wonderful day together, and he was waxing eloquent about Hawkwind and the other bands on his label, you know. And we'd had a lovely time. We had an Italian meal, did the interview, chatted Hawkwind. And I got back into Piccadilly Circus, was staying in London. I got a text from Frenchie saying, I've had a wonderful day, but I've just heard that Hugh Lloyd Langton has died. And it sort of put a real down end to the day on that one. I just remember it so well. And I rang Frenchie back and he was really upset. But what a great player. And yes, Rocky Paths in there is a go-to Huey song as well, isn't it? Moongum became the go-to Huey song, you know. But Rocky Paths is another one. You know, it's just nice, rocky, feel-good. You know, all these songs are quite upbeat in a way, aren't they? You know, they have a sense of goodness that flows through the stuff that Hugh and Marion wrote together. And I love it.
That's beautifully said. For me, I love Rocky Paths. Rocky Paths is reasonably faithful to the Sonic Attack studio album. I'd love to get your views on Pulsing Cavern because obviously that's very much territory that you explore. Master of the Universe is an interesting one, though. I have to confess, I absolutely love this version of Master of the Universe. I can play it over and over and over and over. But it's almost a different song entirely to the original version. Me saying I love this version is not that I think it's better. They're just two completely different things. But this version of Master of the Universe is kind of peak this particular sound of Hawkwind as a band, and definitely peak Dave Brock patented choppy guitar sound.
I would agree. I think this, for me, is one of the pivotal pieces in the entire album from a detailed listening point of view for me. I find if you detailed listen a live album, it tends to change the feeling because, you know, it's live. And so you can pick out mistakes or things that maybe shouldn't have been there. And I've actually enjoyed this album much more when I've been doing something else while it's been on. But Master of the Universe, I do really like listening to because it feels a bit like when they did the 10th anniversary of Silver Machine, where they took a track, actually paid attention to what would it sound like if we made it now and mess with it in positive ways. And I think the 80sification of this track isn't bad. I didn't mind the 80sification version of Silver Machine, but I thought it was a good attempt. I know some people hate it, but I feel like this version of it as well, it's got a solo on it now, which keeps it feeling fresh. I thought the original version was a bit muddy and mumbly and not particularly engaging. I think the speed and the intensity actually really helps the spirit of this. There is also, I feel like, some stereo width coming at the very end of the track as well, which is really nice. So yeah, this for me feels like that kind of Silver Machine-y, taking something and really polishing it up, compared to something like Angels of Death, where I feel like they've just gone, well, what if we played this twice as fast as it needs to be? And then that seems to be all they've done. Master of the Universe feels much more considered. Rocky Paths, I think if any track was going to make sense played at the increased speed and intensity, it was going to be this track, because I already said when we listened to it, this felt like an almost proto US punk track, and speeding it up only makes it more so. But because this was already fast, they left a lot of space between the notes. So when you speed this up more, it still feels considered and still feels together, where I feel like, you know, if you push a more complex track and make it faster, for me, you don't make it more intense. If anything, you just make it more busy. But because this one was quite sparse anyway, compressing it a bit, it's nice. And it's a shame that they couldn't get that zippy synth overlay that I really like in the original. But as a jump around piece, I think it's nicely done and it's well executed. I think Pulsing Cavern got a much better live rendition than Shaygate did. I think Shaygate's fine, but this feels good because they've got that KV, for me, like train tracks at 11 p.m. vibe, and I'm sure that must have sounded great in the room. It's a lovely way of bringing down the energy for a moment and getting a bit competitive and vibey. And it's a shame that they were able to get that thumping sound, but not the depth charge for Seeking. But either way, I think Pulsing Cavern is almost shot for shot, the studio version, and they absolutely nail that. I think I did those tracks in a random order, but that's how I feel.
It's all good. Ian, I'm going to guess that with your punk roots, this version of Masters works for you.
I'm actually going to say no. You're right in what you say as to why I should like it. I love the original. I can take it or leave every other time I've heard it, to be quite honest.
Interesting. It just goes to show there's so much variation in Hawkwind and how you approach it. So for this purpose, I do have the original double live vinyl, but there's so much extra stuff on the various reissues that for the purposes of re-listening, I've been going from the streams on Spotify. And the next track is a piece of Narration, Dragon's Song. Irkun has usurped his throne again, which seems careless, one would have to say. So yeah, a bit of an error here. Someone you would think would have spotted this and sorted it out. It's had 8,240 plays on Spotify to get there. So we'll move swiftly past that one.
I mean, who knows? Maybe people weren't paying attention. Maybe someone was getting a beer and then this is very important. They need to know this.
Exactly. It should be said with more emphasis second time round. So we hit another big Hugh moment, Dreaming City, which I really like, and Choose Your Masks, which is one of my favourite tracks anyway. So there's a good couple of things there. And then, of course, on the album, we have one of those effects moments. We have the fight sequence live, which I've always thought of as the sword solo. So yeah, that takes us up to the break then. Dreaming City, Choose Your Masks, and the fight sequence, Ian.
Dreaming City is gorgeous. Choose Your Masks, I heard it today and thought, I don't remember it like this, and I didn't care for it very much, to be quite honest with you. And the fight sequence is exactly why, as a piece of musical theatre, it doesn't work to include the soundtrack of all the stuff that you can't see going on. But Dreaming City is gorgeous. Love it.
Completely agree. Dreaming City is really nice. It's annoying that it stutters into itself because of the way that Dragon Song is cut. I would love it to come in with a bit more pomp and circumstance, but unfortunately it can't just because of the way it just cuts. And I tried to see if it would fade between Master of the Universe and itself, and it doesn't. So there's some kind of thing there where the recording went awry, I guess.
Well, my guess is, Matt, that there's a piece of narration that's supposed to be there. Because I agree with you, it's annoying that it doesn't come in as beautifully as it should.
Either way, it's a wonderfully constructed piece. It has lots of layers to it. It's really nice to vibe with it. In fact, this and Flight Sequence have interesting vibes that hark, for me, a little bit more back to the 70s-ness. Flight Sequence, I quite like the more haphazard style of it. And I know that I should be watching something, but maybe because it feels more 70s and it's kind of jammy, I actually just find myself wondering back to previous Hawkwind times, and I quite like it. It almost feels like the rules of the gig are being rewritten in front of us, where before it was very much pounding, pounding, strumming, strumming, shouting, shouting, and now it's like, no, actually, now it's all going to be loose and wavy, and it's like, oh my god, cool, Hawkwind can still completely just go wherever they want. So it's short and sensorially it's incomplete, but I do quite enjoy it actually for what it is in this when I listen to it. Choose Your Masks is quite a crazy reinterpretation, actually. You know, it's jittery, it's synthy, there's lots of vocal processing. I feel like it's much less of the story from the studio version. It's more of a sonic event. I can see this being a real hit on the floor again with people like jumping around to this version of it. I thought, you know, the original Choose Your Masks was fine, if a little obtuse in terms of what they were talking about. This version, I actually quite like the interpretation of this. And, you know, it punches out of Dreaming City in a way which really comes at you. And then we go back down into Flight Sequence. So it's this strange burst of energy in between two quite vibey pieces. But I like this one.
Ian, correct me if I'm wrong, but the fight sequence, what we are listening to is Tony Crera, obviously, as Elric, having a fight. And I think it's with Danny Thompson, the drummer, isn't it? He gets up from behind the kit and is waving a sword around.
Yeah, the story is that Danny does some of this and Hugh sits in behind the kit to allow him to do that. When I published the original Sonic Assassins, I was contacted by a guy called Tim Pollard, I believe his name was. Tim, if you're listening, and that wasn't your surname, I do apologise, who was rather disappointed that I hadn't mentioned his appearance in some of these fight sequences. And it's Tim who you can see drawing his finger across his throat in the opening sequence of the video. And he did some of the fight sequence that everybody thinks was Danny, but wasn't Danny. And Tim was very disappointed I hadn't mentioned that. It's very difficult to mention every single person who's ever been involved in Hawkwind in a 120,000 word book. So, yeah, that's the story, that the fight sequence is Danny, and some of it is also Tim, I'm reliably informed.
That's interesting, because at least in my Apple Music version of this, it's flight sequence. So I didn't get any of that. I assume that people were preparing for some kind of magical flight or something. So is it fight sequence or flight sequence?
Fight. That sounds like a typical Hawkwind typo, that one.
But also there's another one called Final Flight later.
Final Flight. Yeah, it has to be fight, surely.
Yeah, because I think they shout fight in Final Flight, so I wasn't sure if maybe like they were censored or something. Someone go, you can't say fight on the back of an album. They're like, oh, we'll shove an L in it, it'll be fine.
I'm holding the Atom Henge reissue, and there it's listed as fight sequence and the final fight.
Isn't that amazing that it's impossible to get the definitive of anything?
Yeah, this is Hawkwind, Matt. This is Hawkwind. There is no definitive answer.
Yeah.
I think I've said this before, like, you know, trying to pin Hawkwind down is like trying to grab hold of a soap in the bath. You know, as soon as you feel like you've got a strong grip on it, it pings away and you have no idea where it's going to land. So I appreciate that. Whenever it happens, I always just chuckle to myself. It's kind of amazing.
Is it Assassins of Allah or is it Hassan al-Shabaab? I say Assassins of Allah because I can pronounce that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we kick off the second half, and this can only go to Matt first, with the long-awaited return of Assault and Battery, followed by Sleep of a Thousand Tears, that you weren't a massive fan on, and the studio album, and Zarazinya. But obviously, Assault and Battery, does it redeem itself here for you, Matt?
Yeah, again, alongside Master of the Universe, I feel like the new version of this has endeared itself a lot more to me. I think losing the big, boring, sorry, Joe, Mellotron makes this track infinitely more listenable to me and allows other things to come through, like this exuberant guitar noodleage for me is far more what I expect from Hawkwind, which is, I think, why the big slab of Mellotron before I found so strange and so at odds with what I was expecting. And I feel like the guitar on this adds a dimension that I'm really grateful for. Again, I think it's slightly faster than it needs to be. I think, again, the profundity of the lyrics, and this is a really well written, I know they took something from a poetry book, but I feel like the profundity of the lyrics lose power with speed. I think they're delivered too fast for me to really enjoy them. So, you know, I wish it was a little bit slower and a little bit more sure of itself to do that. But this version of Assault and Battery is infinitely more interesting to me. I don't know whether or not that redeems me in terms of anyone, but this version of it I like. Sleep of a Thousand Tears, there's a great transition into this track. This is one of the tracks where I consistently really hear the bass coming through. I think recording bass on live tracks, especially around this kind of time, I guess, it's always hard to do. So I'm aware of the bass, but not always aware of it, if that makes sense. But in this time, I hear all these complimentary notes. I hear the bass is adding extra musical fills when there's sparseness in the top sections. It feels live in a good way. This is another track which I feel like the drummer feels really human again. I also feel it's really good to hear the singers hitting the melodic changes, because a lot of the other tracks, they're sung, but they don't need to be sung, if you see what I mean. This track, if you don't get those shift registers right, it's going to sound terrible. But fortunately, the vocals work really hard, and I think they pull it off with style. And I'm really glad at the end of this track, the crowd really gives it up. I think this is a great 1-2 punch for the start of the second part of the gig. And then we go into Zarazinya, which I think is a good choice to give people a break after this rather raucous two tracks. I personally would have maybe elongated the keyboard intro another 4 bars or so, just again to not make it feel like they're on the clock, because I feel like the lyrics come in a little bit sooner than they need, and they could have just wound that down and again being a little bit more... I feel like confident is still the word I appreciate with that. But I think this is nicely sung. I wasn't sure if Brock could nail this live, but I feel like he's still all over it in a cool way. I think maybe this goes on a little longer than it needs to. I feel like it's maybe a touch self-indulgent. I know it loops on the studio album, but I don't mind it on the studio album so much. Maybe it's just because we've just had two very energetic pieces and now this is going on. But I think as a proving that Hawkwind are a band that are capable of strong vocal deliveries live, which I've never really heard in this way, I think getting Sleep of a Thousand Tears and Zarazinya onto here is really good to hear.
Ian, Assault and Battery, you have a slightly different point of view on that one?
I think the best version of Assault and Battery is yet to come. It doesn't happen in the 1980s, and it might be there at the beginning of the 1990s on the particular television performance. Assault and Battery, Sleep of a Thousand Tears, they were combining that one when it did get played in the summer of 85, actually. It was in that format. I'm ambivalent about the way it's played on this album. I don't think it was the right Hawkwind formation for that particular song. And as I say, better is to come. I'm sacrilegious as not having Warrior as one of my top Hawkwind picks anyway. You know, it feels very ploddy on Warrior on the Edge of Time. We're together on that one, Matt. But I am criticised even on Amazon reviews for that. So, yes, I find the version of Assault and Battery on this one is, you know, a bit generic Hawkwind of the mid-80s, if I'm honest, and the best is yet to come for that song. I did have a friend who was a very heavy metal influenced music fan who felt that he'd heard heard the studio version of Sarazinia, felt that the backdrop was Hawkwind walking along in a daze in Afghan coats and, you know, man. And it is a bit like that. But it's quite an evocative song, and it sits there nicely, you know, both on Life Chronicles and on the studio album, which is why in my imaginary universe, it's prefaced by Moonglum on the studio version, not by Dreaming City. Dreaming City can still be the little gem that emerges from the Live Chronicles album and doesn't have to have its studio baggage carried with it.
No, that's fair. I think you wonder what a studio versions of those tracks would be. Interestingly, on the original double live vinyl, Assault and Battery and Sleep of a Thousand Tears are not on it. And the running order is very different. We go from Choose Your Masks to Needle Gun to Zarazinia. In the reissues, Needle Gun is much further down. But I had an EP called Independent Days, the first one of which was my introduction to Valium 10. I'd also had the Hawkwind version of Motel on it, the first time I heard it. The second volume has Assault and Battery, Sleep of a Thousand Tears. And I really liked it and then was a bit gutted when I eventually got Live Chronicles and found that it wasn't on it. So I was very pleased coming back to the streams to find that it's in there, because I always really liked it. Very similar to how I like Master of the Universe. I treat it almost, it's not really the same track. It's something very different. Regarding Zarazinia, you know, as was said on the original pod, I don't really do ballads at the best of times, and I'm not a massive fan. It's not a skipper, but the live versions of it that I've heard, I do prefer. Nothing for Zarazinia will beat the live orchestrated version that Mike Batt did much more recently with the orchestra and the strings, but anything that has a lot of mellotron-y kind of sounds in it or benefits from actual strings from an orchestra. But I do prefer this to the studio album, and I wonder whether that is almost because of its placing after those energetic keyboard, big rocky songs. The contrast works as a running order for me better here than it does with its placement on the studio album.
But I think that's the right order as well, isn't it? If you look at some of the other tapes from the tour, I mean, there's a soundboard that circulates from Sheffield, and that runs Assault and Battery, Sleep with Thousand Tears, Zarazinia, has Brainstorm in it as well, which doesn't make the Atom Henge reissue. And I'd written about Brainstorm being included in the set because I sort of remembered that from Bristol. And then when I was looking at it today, I thought, was that something I wrote that was wrong? So even though, Matt, they were racing to get through the songs, they still had room for a couple more.
I'm going to have to dig out that version of Brainstorm. Moving on. We now have some instrumentals and some more spoken word stuff for a little while. Lords of Chaos, The Dark Lords, Wizards of Pantang. I actually find it hard to remember which is which out of those because they kind of blend in together. Before we get to Moonglum, which is obviously a favourite of yours, Ian, and then Elric the Enchanter. And interestingly, we get the second half of that, which both Matt and I liked the second half more than the first half. So that kind of works for us.
I think Moonglum is one of those fan favourites, though, isn't it? You know, when Huey came back in the band in the 2000s, you know, that was the song he brought back with him again. And people love it, even though it seems like a muddled mess of lyrics. But it's just nice. And again, it's that Marion and Hugh thing about people.
Matt, you texted me to say that you were struggling with the lyrics of Moonglum because you hadn't read the stories. And then I sent you Moonglum and Eric hunting Theleb Kana, my Sheller now replacing Queen Yashana, which basically, if you don't know the stories.
I thought you'd accidentally sent me your crypto wallet password. Wizards of Pantang sounds like Time We Left This World Today. It's got this kind of chant where it sounds like you're saying, is he here or course he's here or something like that. There's mm-hmm. that kind of thing, which does a bit to try and pull my attention back as a listener after Lord of Chaos and Dark Lords are just like a lot of talking and I'm kind of like, eh, whatever. But Moonglum, the first time I heard this, I actually started laughing because the incomprehensibility of the lyrics mixed with the delivery and the way it's recorded, I was like, is this Swedish or something? Like, it didn't even sound English to me. So unfortunately, as tracks go, you know, it's got a lot of craft and energy to it and, you know, it's got good song structure, but the lyrics... Half of it for me sounds like it's not English, and then suddenly there's words which I do get, but they're words which, again, without context, don't make a lot of sense to me anyway. So at the risk of being unpopular, this is not the way that I need to be introduced to this track.
That's the funny thing, isn't it? You know, and I haven't read all of the Elric books. I've read a lot of Mike Moorcock, but I haven't read all of the Elric books. And this is one of those ones from the show that's completely narrative driven with the books. It's the one that always transcended the shows and lived in the set whenever Huey was there, really, you know. And people love it. It's a little charming song, you know. And the fact that it's incomprehensible, who cares? It's a charmer.
It's a big crowd favourite for sure.
It's very positive. It's got a lot of upbeatness to it. So I can see why. Like I said, I think sonically it's working. I just need to listen to it in a way which is not this one to really appreciate it. Because otherwise, for me, I still have trouble understanding anything. And a lot of it does sound like a foreign language thing. So I find it hard to gel with.
It'll still not make any sense in the lyrics.
Maybe not. Yeah. No. But the fact it drops into the sudden breakdown of Elric the Enchanter, I did not see coming, but I like it. I think that, again, that must have been the kind of thing that got people live really excited, was suddenly like, oh, didn't see that coming. That's cool. It's funny how at the current speed the gig is going, this half-time drop sounds almost normal speed. And I think if anything, that just again makes me realize, oh yeah, this is still like quite a breakneck set, even as we get into the final acts of it. I like the fact they let riff part breathe before they start singing over it, in the same way I think they didn't with Zarazenia. So I like the fact that there's extra effects and noodleage and stuff before, and you can just let that riff pound out for a second. Of sorcery to the test is still not my favorite line and is not made any better in the live delivery. But a little kind of Easter egg of Elric the Enchanter in here is a welcome addition to the latter half of the set.
Excellent. So we move on and we have a nice clutch of tracks here, starting with Needle Gun, which both Matt and I thought was a huge amount of fun. Conjuration of Magnu and Magnu. That's a pretty strong little set there, Ian.
Yeah, nice pacey version of Needle Gun. I guess Needle Gun was outside of the concept and brought into it. As I said, you know, I think it'd have been better as a standalone single, but it still sort of works in the context of the songs written by Roger Neville Neal, a friend of mine from when I wrote the Hawkwind book. So I think it was, you know, it definitely wasn't written for Black Sword because Roger was just having a go at writing some lyrics and sending them to Dave. So, you know, I wouldn't have done that, I'm sure, in the context of contributing to the Black Sword album. It's, you know, it's a set of lyrics of him thinking about Jerry Cornelius as a character, so very much outside of the run of Black Sword, but I think it's a good sing-along. It feels like another attempt at, oh, could we get another Silver Machine? There is no other Silver Machine. But it's a time where you feel like you're just trying to find another one that would help fill the coffers of what was becoming a cottage enterprise at that point in a way. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but it was very much a smaller enterprise that was living from day to day and doing these great things on very limited budget. So the idea of trying to find another single that would get them somewhere completely makes sense to me.
I agree. Max, Needle Gun and Magnu were both tracks that I remember you liking.
Yeah, Magnu, again, it's one of the riffs which survives being sped up a little bit. It's nice to hear one that I liked being folded in. So yeah, certainly enjoyed that. I think Needle Gun is really nicely done. I like the kick at the beginning to get you into it. I think it's very faithful to the studio version. I think the little tweaks and the slightly different lyrical deliveries, they're fun touches. Even I think there's a bit where someone says like Reedle around the 2.5 minute mark, like they get one of the needles wrong, which again, for me, has that lovely live charm of the fact that trying to say needle that many times is probably a lot to do, as well as, you know, running around and playing music. And at this point, they've been playing for over an hour. I'm sure gig fatigue starts to set in, but it's just kind of charming. So I like it. Surprise drum fills in the second half, which again reminds me that this isn't a drum machine. I'm not sure if they needed to be there, but I guess it just adds some variance, which is fine. I think they're saying Evil Needle Gun at the end, but they end on Needle Gun, which is unsatisfying. I like saying Evil as the last one, but it feels like they say Evil on like the third or the second and just end on Needle, which is fine. I think the studio version is still technically better, but I think this is as good a version as you could get live. And they still clearly have a lot of passion and fun with it. And again, hearing the solo sing over the top of it and everything, there's just a lot of raw energy here, which still makes me feel like it was a good pick for our playlist.
I would love to hear them do Needle Gun now. I'm not sure whether they would, but I think they could do a hell of a version of it. Interestingly, Conjuration of Magnu doesn't half remind me of Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun by Pink Floyd. It's only a couple of minutes and it's a fleeting thing, but I always get that in my head when I hear it. So we draw to a close with three other songs. And Matt, one of these again was a favourite because I have a feeling that Dust of Time was one of your picks, if not the pick, from Levitation for the Sessions playlist. And then another punch up between Tony Crera and either Danny Thompson or Tim. And then Horn of Fate at the end, Matt. Dust of Time, does it work for you in this live way?
It transitions nicely from Magnu. I was expecting Magnu to end with a little more ceremony. I thought they'd expect to get some applause from that one, but they just went straight into it, which is cool. It's funny hearing this as a total instrumental because Dust of Time did not have that. And it makes the bit which I was never a huge fan of, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do part of it, it makes it even harder for me to appreciate when it comes out of nowhere. I think that Dust of Time warrants the lyrics and maybe a slightly longer time to breathe. So it was nice to hear it. I think it's more caught up in the general noise of things. So I don't think it's as good as the studio version. It's more of a tag because it's not even that long. It's like just over 2 minutes. So it feels like they're just putting it in there to put it in there. The final flight or fight, depending. This is what I said at the beginning, that they do a kind of like Shakespearean couplets to remind everyone what's been going on. You know, this one has a little rhyming thing. It's almost like, okay, we've learned a lot today, or, you know, we've heard a lot of music, but what is the key takeaway from this gig? And again, I don't like the heavy metal songs just cut themselves another line. It's surprising to me, given everything that we've heard about Hawkwind and their spaciness. I feel like it's almost ironic that they say it over this track, as this track isn't punk based in any way. It feels more like a 70s style poetry reading from something like Warrior compared to, you know, everything else we've been listening about. But, you know, we're clearly gearing up for the finale. So perfectly fine way of wrapping it up in a Hawkwindy way, that lyric notwithstanding, and makes me wonder where they're going to go from here. But Horn of Fate, the Elric sword boing, makes its final return, which is kind of nice to hear as it's been around and is now one of those things which I just now associate with this time. It's kind of the catchphrase of the album and the tour. The unison singing along to the beat does sound cool. Again, I like the fact that the drummer's allowed to really join in with the band with the toppy drums that you haven't heard in any of this before. So it feels like, again, adding to a little bit of the jamminess. I think it's probably not the track that I would have closed with. I feel like it lacks a little bit of final substance, but it's well delivered and it ends on some energy, which I like. And I kind of like the fact that when they say goodbye, they fade out on the crowd chanting Hawkwind. I think that's a nice way of ending it and makes it feel like it was obviously a roaring success of an evening. So I'm left on a general high. And at least this ends, Andy, because if this had finished on some kind of screeching car crash into broken glass and like a explosion or something, then I would have vetoed any live album talking ever again.
I think it builds to a relentlessness in the final moments, doesn't it? But, you know, again, because the live album of a visual acted piece, you lost all the context of it again, you know. So that's the difficulty with this one as a live album compared to Space Ritual as a live album with the poems floating in and out. So it's supposed to have some sort of narrative thread, but it isn't a, you know, it isn't an acted piece of musical theatre, which Black Sword almost tries to be in its presentation, you know. So I think that's why this one as a studio album loses that sense of its narrative, particularly if you don't know all the stories. But seeing it live and watching the acted pieces, you get a whole sense of what's going on. And of course, you know, as you get to the end here, you have to ask yourself, well, what happened? What really was the end here? What's the payoff to this?
It's true. I think the way they've done things before, like, even though I hate the fact they blew up the last live album we talked about, it was something which at least addressed the listener from an album point of view. And I guess I was wondering whether or not there was going to be something that drew this to a climax. Maybe I over expect from Hawkwind because they surprise me so often that sometimes I'm like, oh, they're going to do something, and then they don't. And it's like, it's not their fault that they didn't. It's my fault for having maybe too many expectations. But I think it's maybe a good expectation to have that they might do something crazy. It's a bit like the end of the Space Ritual. Is that the one where they just talk about the football?
Yeah, on the streams. On the vinyl, it cuts
right.
Well before that. But yeah, in the streams, you get the extra bit.
Yeah, you know, that completely throws me out of it. So it's funny to be reminded that at the end, and they are still a band. You know, I'm not sure if that makes sense.
At least it didn't end with a bit of narration where we learn that he's been usurped for a third time.
So that'd be great. That'd be great just at the end when everyone walks off and they're all like going, Hawkwind, Hawkwind. One person just comes back and just goes, just so we all remember. He was usurped, but he's not dead. But they think he's dead, but he's not dead.
He's not dead. So that ends the concert of Chronicle of the Black Sword, and quite the event, obviously, it was. I mean, it brings back a lot of memories for me seeing it at the World Science Fiction Convention all those years ago, and doubtless for Ian seeing it in Bristol. We'll have a little look here at the album artwork, which is by Bob Walker, who did that inner sleeve illustration of Elric. There's an illustration. I love this. Not sure what its connection with Elric is. Matt brought up a beautiful point that why is 5 p.m. nuclear o'clock? Ian, any thoughts or feelings about that piece of artwork?
I was always very disappointed when I went out and bought the original double album and saw the front cover and thought, this is really striking stuff. And then it's a single sleeve and it was just two pieces of vinyl in white wrappers. And it's like, oh, is this what it is? And I was always a little bit down on it. It feels like it should have been something, you know, like Space Ritual. It feels like it should have been something more than it was in terms of the packaging. It, you know, it looks great, but the overall packaging is not commensurate with the epicness of what's etched into the vinyl, I'm afraid.
It feels like quite a strangely low-key release. I remember not knowing it existed and was looking just through a record shop and seeing it and going, what's this? But yeah, as a major release, you could imagine there's booklets and tour photographs and everything would go in there. Matt, what did you make of it?
This is one of the rare times when I could get a very high definition version of the album, so I can get a real look at it. Did you say this was done by the same person who did the inner sleeve, which is that drawing of Elric raising the sword, looking horrified?
That's the one. Yeah, Bob Walker.
Wow, he's come on a bit, because I think I damned that saying it was like GCSE artwork level illustration. This I would not have clocked, so this is way nicer. So I hope karmically that I've addressed the respect balance there. That being said, it just gives you a lot of questions. Like, yeah, is that Elric? What are the two faces in the columns? Why is 5 o'clock a specific time when the mushroom cloud appears? Is there a reason? Maybe it's just completely random. I don't know. There's also this kind of PXR5 wire in the top corner, which I was wondering if that was some kind of reference to the fact that this is electric and heavy metal somehow, despite being what looks very fantastical.
Good Lord. I had never noticed that before.
Yeah, neither had I. Neither had I. You'd said something there, Matt.
Yeah. You've been saying it, and I've been looking at the cover going, what? Where? Oh, yeah. That's truly bizarre.
We're perplexed by the content of the sleeve, because it sort of almost cries out for one of those 1970s Frank Frazetta, Boris Vallejo type covers that we used to get on the Spear versions of the Conan books when they were being reissued.
Which is what the inside cover of Black Sword was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. And this does look completely different. It is a lovely image, and definitely that image would be one of the things that attracted me to the album when I saw it in the record shop, for sure. But as you say, it doesn't seem to reflect the content. Should have been a much more beautiful fold-out thing. So it's a strange little mix. Again, it's very Hawkwind to do something like this.
Great cover, very intriguing. Shame about the packaging wasn't what I'd rather expected when I knew it was coming out.
Exactly. I just ran away for a second there to see where this album lands with Hawkwind fans. And unsurprisingly, it's fairly high. It comes in at about number 13 in the Hawkwind fans worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums by Elric Newby. So it's beneath Chronicle of the Black Sword, but not by very much. I think Space Ritual is the only live album that's above it. So it's pretty well thought of by Hawkwind fandom.
Yeah, I think so. That was why I was quite surprised about the amount of negativity about both albums and the tour and the accompanying imagery. Although that photo that everybody's dissing is not the best image from the tour, you know. So, you know, there was a set of photos. I can't remember who took them. They might have been the picnic pictures that were available. You could send off and buy them. And most of them were shots from the actual stage show. And a couple were same check type ones, days wearing an ordinary Hawkwind t-shirt and stuff. I still got those somewhere. And they're much better visualization of what's actually happening. And that picture of the band all standing with Tony and Chris in masks that they weren't wearing during the show and stuff is a little bit bordering on the edge, shall we say. But, you know, there's some other great visualization around, and you would have hoped that that package back in the day would have reflected that. There's certainly some good pictures that were taken that really told you that it was, for its budget, a really nice presentation, you know.
Absolutely. We'll try and dig some of those out so we can put them out when we release this pod. Ian, we're drawing to a close. One of the things that we do on these shows, we have some playlists on Spotify. The master playlist, which is Matt's singular pick, and a sessions playlist where we put on a couple of tracks from each album that we like in amongst a lot of other stuff that we've talked about on previous pods. I think as our special guest of such magnitude, we definitely should give you a guest pick for a track to go on the Hawkwind sessions playlist on Spotify. As long as you don't pick, Irkun has usurped his throne.
Oh, I've got to have another think now, haven't I?
I'm afraid you're going to have to think of something else, yeah.
He has him done away with, or pretends to have him done away with. Well, which is it? I would like to pick Dreaming City because it's, you know, it's a lesser known song. It hung around the set for 18 months or so. It's played on the Chaos Tour, appears on the video that was taken from Preston from that gig, and then it's disappeared and hasn't had the longevity that Moonglum has. But it surfaces out of the album as an unknown song. It's a really gorgeous song, and I would like to commend that one to the playlist, please.
Commended it is. Matt, your pick for the master playlist first.
I might put the Master of the Universe on.
Good.
Yeah, because that's what you wanted?
Yes.
Fair enough.
Also, it's interesting that when we did 25 years, there was a track that you liked, but you didn't choose it for the playlist because you knew there was a live version coming that you were going to choose. And I remember that when we did the original In Search of Space, Master wasn't one of the ones that you picked because, as you've said on this pod, you weren't quite as into it. It wasn't quite the revelatory track for you that it was for me. Well, obviously it was for me, but these aren't my picks. So now Master of the Universe does get on, which makes me very happy.
Cool. Yeah, and it's just a nice version of it, brought more up to date, maybe in a way which I personally appreciate more. I like the energy of it. It's a good one to hear when it comes on, which is really cool. So yeah, definitely happy to add that one. Adding to an extra sessions track, I think I want to add the Pulsing Caverns because I think that's a really nice version of it. Considering the sessions is a little bit more eclectic and showing the whole range of what Hawkwind can do, I think being able to show Master of the Universe and Shake It, weird that they're just next to each other actually in the set list, I just remembered, but the fact that they can do both of those things live with such quality and attention to detail in those two tracks, I think is a really good testament to their genre-defying work, even if everything is slightly squished into this more heavy, punky vibe, which I can take or leave in this version. But even though I'm generally not the biggest fan of it, Pulsing Caverns survived and Master of the Universe was improved. So I think it's also proof that anything they do that generally I may not be a fan of, I can normally find an exception to that because they still colour outside the lines of their own rules quite a lot.
Outstanding. This has been fun, Ian. You have been a wonderful guest. It's been brilliant having you on. Thanks so much.
I've really enjoyed it, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. It's brilliant, brilliant fun.
Well, hopefully we'll find an excuse to get you back on again in future.
I'd be delighted. I really would.
So thanks again to Ian and thanks to everybody. By the way, I've discovered through looking at our stats when I saw that our listenership had increased through Quark and Black Sword, also saw that 52% of our listens come through Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And those platforms have one thing in common, and that is that you can rate and review. And we could really do with some rates and reviews. That would really help us to keep reaching these bigger audiences, which is a massively fun thing for us to do and broaden these debates and discussions that we all have. We will return with Xenon Codex. For now, I hope that all of you manage to avoid being usurped, and we will see you soon.
You've been listening to Hawk Binge. It was devised and presented by Andy Hood and Matt Longstaff. The soundtrack was produced by Don Music Presents. To contact the show, drop us a message on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter by searching at HawkBinge or send an email to podcast@hawkbinge.space. HawkBinge is part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. To find more great band-focused podcasts like this one, head to @deepdivepodnet on Twitter and dive in. Thank you as always for listening. We'll see you next time.
Had this girlfriend once, only for a short period of time, but I'd met her at an English literature evening class that I'd gone to. I'd seen her across the room, and lo and behold, me and my mate Stuart ran into her in the pub the following week. We'd been talking about Hawkwind, so she came over and said, Hawkwind, who's going to win the war then? And we said, you don't know anything about Hawkwind, though, do you? And she said, I don't know anything about Hawkwind. Do you prefer the very polished studio version of Black Sword, or do you like the rawness of the live album? I said, can I buy a drink?